Ahoy, awesome alliance of alert and adorable attendees. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 106. And of course, I am your humble host, Karen, and we are your bumbling but barely beastly bunch of brain buffs.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And no Chris this week. He is in Boston at PAX, PAX East, the video game convention. And he already told me that some Good Job Brain fans already recognized
him.
Yeah. And said awesome. Hi. So very, very cool. Before we start the show,
yes,
we have a giant correction segment.
Actually, what you said just wasn't true. Actually, do you mind if I correct you? Because actually, factually, and quite enthusiastically, I was right, and you were wrong. That's exactly what inspired me to write this actually song. You were wrong.
We have a big actually 2 episodes ago in our April Fool's episode. Chris is not here. It was actually his mistake.
That's why he's not here.
He talked about some of the famous April Fool's jokes around the world. And one of them was from a news segment. It was about the spaghetti farmers. And he said it was the Swedish spaghetti farmers, but actually it's the Swiss.
Right.
And none of us caught it.
No.
It was kind of embarrassing, but at the same time, like when I was fact checking it, when I was editing it, I was like, it's Swiss. But I didn't want to take out the whole segment because it was funny.
Yeah, so, yeah. Mm-hmm. We apologize to 2 countries.
Yes.
Whoops. So thank you guys for all your emails and posts telling us that we got it wrong. Thank you very much. All right, then let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hot Shot. Here, I have a random Trivial Pursuit card. Oh, no. All right. And you guys have your barnyard buzzers.
Yes,
I just see the
first
question.
Are there pictures or something?
No, I just see the first question.
Okay.
I was like, I'm going to botch this up. All right, so Colin versus Dana. Here we go. Oh, boy. Blue Wedge for Geography. I'm so sorry if I'm pronouncing this wrong. In what country is the town of Lanfair, Pula, Gwenagilla, Gogur, Chiwano, Drobe, Willen, Chisigogo, Gosh located?
I'm going to guess, based on your laughter and the mangling, Wales. It sounds like a mangled Welsh name.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Lots of L's and G's.
Lots of
and
double
Y's.
Letters.
Yeah.
Do they have the correct pronunciation on there in parentheses?
Not.
Oh, that's not helpful.
Yeah.
I could have like researched it, how to really pronounce it right, but I think that's not random.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, you're not going to do that in the middle of your Trivial Pursuit game at home.
It is Welsh for St. Mary's Church in the Hollow of White Hazel near a rapid whirlpool and the Church of St. Tisilio of the Red Cave.
Very descriptive.
It sounds
helpful.
Like a Game of Thrones thing.
They want to make sure you don't confuse it with the next town
There's
over.
Another one, not by a whirlpool, that is
just by a moderate pool. All right, Pink Wedge for pop culture. Name 2 of the 3 Jonas Brothers.
Maybe together we can...
Okay, Dana?
Nick and Joe.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all we had to do is 2 of the 3, right?
What's the other one?
The only one I knew was Joe. The only one I knew was Joe.
There's a Kevin.
Oh.
Yeah. Kevin, Joe, and Nick.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Yellow Wedge. Name 2 of the 4. There's a lot of name blank out of blank. Okay. Name 2 of the 4 U.S. presidents who have won a Nobel Peace Prize.
Okay. We could do this together, too. So
Barack Obama,
right?
Ding, 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 ding.
Bill Clinton. Did he win?
No.
Jimmy Carter?
Yes.
Yeah, for
Nobel Peace Prize.
Carter, Obama, maybe Roosevelt? Yeah, like Theodore Roosevelt.
Which one?
Theodore?
Yes. Yeah. And one last one. Woodrow Wilson.
Interesting. Okay.
Oh, I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. That's a good list. Okay.
Right.
Wilson, Roosevelt, Obama, Carter. Okay.
I'm trying to see if I can
come up with a mnemonic.
Yeah. Cow R. No.
Cow R?
Crow. Crow, cow R.
Cow. If only there was something that made more sense than
with
cow
the letter
R.
C-R.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we'll come back to that another
cow
time.
Cow R. Carter, Roosevelt, Obama, Wilson.
Okay. Crow. The Crow Nobel.
All right.
Okay.
All right. I like
Crow,
that.
Crowbell.
Crowbell.
Crowbell Peace Prize. On the fly. We're just loosening up. Okay. Let's see. Purple Wedge. What structure did the Chrysler Building surpass in 1929 as the tallest building in the world?
1929 surpassed. Oh, would it be Eiffel Tower? What do you think, Dana? We'll do a team answer.
Was the Eiffel Tower the tallest? I guess.
Or maybe it was. I mean, I know the Brooklyn Bridge was tallest at one point.
Hmm.
Although at Eiffel Tower.
Sure.
Since when are we voting?
It's a team
it's
answer.
It's more collaborative. Okay. It is
the Eiffel Tower.
Okay.
And we actually have this once in trivia. Which building is taller, the Eiffel Tower or the Space Needle?
Right, in Seattle.
Eiffel Tower.
I knew that. I got voted down.
Yeah.
We all thought, Space Needle is a more modern structure, probably.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, yeah. Green Wedge for science. When was the computer mouse patented? 1970,
uh-huh.
1978, or 1984?
Oh, I think it's the earliest.
70, 78, 84.
I think it was like one of those like Xerox Park
made
labs.
It, yeah.
I would say that whatever the earliest one is, yeah.
You are correct, yeah. Colin. 1970. The first computer designed to use a mouse came out in 1973.
Okay.
All right, last question. Orange Wedge for sports and leisure. What popular toy was first introduced as the Power Drencher?
The Super Soaker?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Must be. Yeah. They're like, oh, guys, we're so close. Oh, yeah. Is there any way we can get some alliteration in here?
Yeah. We just need some.
The Power Drencher. Like, if you were going to make a knockoff of the Super Soaker, the Power Drencher. Yeah. That's great.
Super Soaker, correct. And we have a Lobe Trotter question. Lobe Trotters are our fan club members who bought a fan club pack last year. Is from Liam. What was the Lucky Loony? This is actually a sports related thing, so I don't know, Colin.
It sounds Canadian.
It does sound. I would agree with that
because they're money.
Loony, yes. Yeah, Loony is a Canadian coin.
Something with a duck if it's sports, is it?
Something with if you're giving me the sports clue, I'm going to go hockey.
Correct.
Okay. Man, we're getting in probably like the most shallow area of my sports knowledge, which is hockey. I don't know. I think that's as far as we can get it. So a lucky shot in a big game maybe or something.
Is it like the coin flip?
The coin is actually, it is referring to the coin.
Oh,
the coin
it is. Lucky. Oh, okay. Was this the coin flip for the team that got the rights to draft somebody or something like that?
Nope.
Okay, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
You were so excited.
I thought I was onto something.
Okay.
So in 2002, the Winter Olympics, there was for the hockey or for the rink, they had a consultant, Dan Craig, and he's from Edmonton, Canada. Him and his whole team were there to be consultants. And what they did was they hid a coin, a loony coin. At first it was a dime, but it was a little bit too small to see. They hid a loony coin in the middle of the rink underneath the ice and didn't tell anybody about it except for the Canadian teams. That year, both men and women's team won. And so that coin was dug up, and then it got really popular. They even did reprints of the coin, even though it's just a loony.
Right.
Because it was like, sports.
Which is a $1 coin. Is that what that is?
I think so. Yeah, because there's the toonie, which is the $2.
Yeah.
I like that.
So that is the Lucky Loony, 2002 Winter Olympics.
Which is probably somewhere in the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame today.
No, they gave it to Wayne Gretzky.
Oh.
They actually gave the coin. The actual coin, but they also remade a bunch of them.
Nice.
The Lucky Loony. Well, thank you, Liam. That was a very Canadian heavy or hockey heavy fact.
That's a good one.
That's
a good one.
All right. So this week, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's Coachella, which is the music festival that's going on. There's PAX, which is the video game stuff going on. There's Easter is coming up. Seems like it's a really festive time. So this week we decided to explore the world of partying and celebration and festivities. Yeah.
Spring break is coming up.
Oh, spring break is coming up. That's true. So, time to party.
Make up your mind, sweet babe. Right here, right now is all we got. A little party never killed nobody. So we gonna dance until we drop. A little party never killed nobody.
All right, I will get us going with a little party for the brains, if you will.
Sounds super cool. You party animal, you.
You guys can do this as a team if you want. Only two of you here. We'll, you know, relax the rules a little bit.
Okay.
I've noticed that I was doing, you know, kind of just some brainstorming research, as I always do for the show, and I noticed that a lot of party terminology are loan words or very common terms we get from other languages.
Oh.
So I've got a few choice select samples here for you. These are terms that we hear all the time that we may not know the meanings of.
Oh, okay. From different languages.
From different languages. Well, from at least three languages, yes.
Got it. Piñata.
So we will we'll get started here, warm up your brains together. Okay. So when you guys are invited to a party, often be asked to RSVP. Yeah. So please, please enlighten us and tell us, what does RSVP stand for?
Répondez, s'il vous plaît.
You guys, so close, very close.
Yeah. What?
It's répondez. Répondez. Yeah, but fair enough. I will absolutely give you guys...
Please respond.
I'll give you credit for that one. That's right. Répondez, s'il vous plaît. Please respond. Unless otherwise stated on the invitation, you guys may or may not know that, you know, the really strict etiquette is... means respond either way.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't just mean let me know if you're coming. It means let me know if you're coming or if you're not coming so I can plan. Okay.
Yeah.
So like weddings.
Weddings especially, things
that's
like
super
that.
Parties formal. Or whatever.
Yeah. You're if like, you're following like the really formal, you know, like we talked about Emily Post on the show, you know, she's like, it's like bad etiquette not
nowadays,
to respond.
Maybe, or you say maybe. You're going and you don't show up.
Yeah.
Because you're like, I'm too tired.
I feel like with like,
we're in
internet.
A generation of flakes.
Just say, yes, I don't want to look like a jerk by being in the no list.
Yeah.
I would say most of the people who select yes show up.
I'm always like, that sounds fun. That sounds fun. Yes, yeah. I'll go. Yes, I'll go. And then Wednesday comes, I was like, I'm tired.
There's like a 60% chance.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
like maybe.
Yeah. It's better than 50-50.
Yeah. Horrible.
So let's assume that you do, in fact, go ahead and attend that party. And you show up. It's a fancy party. And when you arrive, you are served with some hors d'oeuvres.
All right.
Get your appetite going there. So you guys, I'm sure, correctly assume that this is a French term.
Correct.
Yes. You're not getting points for that. You're not getting points for assuming
it's French.
It has
an apostrophe
in it. It does. I'll even spell it for you if you'd like. It's H-O-R-S-D apostrophe O-U-V-R-E-S.
Okay, I know...
So the question, as you can probably guess, is what does hors d'oeuvre mean in French?
Okay, I think, that's oeufs. I was like, I think that means egg. It sounds like it, but it's not the same word. Oh, man. You know what? I know amuse-bouche. I don't know what
it's
hors d'oeuvre
is. Teaser.
Yeah.
You probably know
mouth pleasure.
You probably have heard mouth pleasurer. So hors d'oeuvre means outside the main work, outside the main dish. Outside. So if the main dish is the primary work of the meal, these are things aside from the main course.
Which one is the work?
Oof.
Okay.
Yeah, and then or is outside. Yeah.
Okay.
At New Year's Eve parties,
yep.
Particularly in English-speaking countries, there's a good chance that at the stroke of midnight, you'll hear people singing Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah.
So tell me, what does Auld Lang Syne mean?
It's Latin.
Yeah.
It's not Latin.
Is it?
It does sound
German?
Latin. I'll give you a little bit of it. It was written by Robert Burns, one of his most famous compositions.
Okay.
It's Scots.
Okay.
Something about the times?
Yeah, yeah.
Song of the times?
I'll give it to you. It's like times gone by.
Yeah.
Like days gone by.
So poetic.
Times long ago. So in Scots, it would literally translate most closely. Auld Lang Syne would be old long since.
Is it that song?
That's the song. That's the one.
Sitting here, I was like, "What song are they talking about?"
Which he kind of put the words to an existing tune.
Okay.
You know, so it was like that melody is an old melody that we sort of paired with Auld Lang Syne.
Kind of like our national anthem, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Star Spangled Banner.
Happy Birthday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an existing tune. They put words to it.
Also, yep, exactly. All right, last one. You might spot this item at a children's birthday party. And though it is usually associated with Mexican culture, the name itself is ultimately derived from an Italian word for pine cone. What am I talking about? Oh, Karen. Pinata. Yes, pinata. Yeah,
sorry, I ruined in the beginning of the show. I was like, I know pinata.
I'm pretty impressed, though. You right off the bat. Yeah, you knew pinata was going to be there.
Well, do you know pinatas used to not be like paper mache animals?
Yes.
They used to be a clay pot that kids would beat up.
You are absolutely right.
It would shatter into a bunch of pieces with kids running around.
Yeah. That seems easier to break.
Well, it's not glass. Like it's not like, you know, it's clay.
But still.
No, you were absolutely
right. Trying to fish through the candies through shards of pottery.
The sort of the modern pinata that we have, like that practice was introduced to Mexico by the Spanish. The original practice, before they started getting fancier and more decorated, was it would be a fairly simple, just kind of earthenware clay pot. Yeah. Nice. It seems like it's one of these things where like sort of the European Spanish style tradition meshed well with some existing traditions.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of cultures, I mean, it's sort of simple. Yeah. A lot of cultures have some variation on the hitting an object with treats inside celebration.
It's funny, one of the segments I was going to talk about, I was going to do like a history of Pin the Tail on the Donkey, which I couldn't really find that much about it, but a lot of different cultures have a similar game. And, you know, we put the tail on the donkey, but in Japan, they put, like, eyebrows on the guy. You know, it's really... And I was like, that's funny. Of course, there's a tradition where you beat the crap out of a thing to make candy
come out. Get something good out of the middle, sure. All right, well done, guys.
Speaking of Mexican Aztec culture, they were the first people who made animal-shaped balloons.
Whoa!
But they would take...
I'm afraid to ask, out of what?
Guess. I mean,
it's
out of like...
Intestine? It's gotta be intestine. Okay.
So from small animals, and they had a special thread, and they'd sew it up, and then they'd blow some air into it and twist it a bit and let it harden in the sun, and then put more air in it and twist it more and let it harden. Because if you think about working with guts or gristle, it would be really hard to blow it up and twist it. So
and
there's a whole process.
That it's like airtight.
Yeah. And then they'd do some like religious rites with it, and they'd make them into the shape of dogs or some kind of like a special kind of donkey, which is awesome.
I would imagine then the balloon animals back then, they were hard. They're not flexible, bouncy. They're like, almost like a statue or like a sculpture.
Yeah, or like a paper mache almost, it sounds like.
But it's a bladder that's been inflated.
What a fun child's toy.
So the rubber balloons, though, where did those come from? It was for scientific research.
Oh, really?
This guy invented it.
For like capturing vapors or something?
He was doing experiments with hydrogen, the gas, and so he took some rubber and he made two rounds. He put some flour between them. He sealed the edges and then he forced hydrogen into it and floated. And he's like, whoa, look at that. And then the next year, they made balloons commercially available to people. There was a kit and it had like a jar of rubber, liquid rubber and a syringe.
weird.
It wasn't until the late 1800s that they got it going, and you could get them from like Montgomery Ward's catalogs, and became a huge novelty right around the Depression. Actually, that's when they really started.
You know, kids want captured air.
Yeah.
It's like the cheapest.
They're so neat though.
Yeah, they are.
So the modern balloons, most of the rubber ones are actually made out of latex. And so you fill them up with helium. They leave the atmosphere. They freeze when they get into the really cold air.
Oh, really?
And then they break up and become really thin spaghetti-like strips of... And then when they go to the ground, they're biodegradable. They're like pieces of leaves.
That's good.
So, okay. So it's less terrible.
All right. I'm going to start releasing even more balloons every day then.
Because I think about when I go to Disneyland, which is a lot, I see all the kids like crying because they accidentally left the Mickey ear balloons out floating
in
the air.
That is good.
And I'm
to hear,
where do they go?
They'll probably return to the earth.
Yeah. But they freeze. That's interesting.
That is really cool. I did that once as a kid. I wrote, with my dad's help, he helped me, I wrote, a message, and, we, weatherproofed it and tied it to a helium balloon and just released it. And then, if you find this, call us at whatever. Aww. And then nothing happened. Of course, we never heard anything about it again.
It probably broke up into little pieces. Yeah. Nobody could read it.
Oh, the note. The note did.
Also, the odds of it landing,
on land.
Near a human or
who will entertain that and want to do it.
Some walrus somewhere. I'll let you know if I ever hear back from the balloon.
I want to know.
It's been over 20 years. I probably not going to hear back at this point.
So I want to talk about a party That we probably are all familiar with, but for like me, I've heard about it, but I don't know the details. It's coming up. It's going to be in August.
Okay.
And it's La Tomatina. Have you guys heard of it?
Yes.
It's the tomato fight festival.
Right.
In Spain.
Right. I've seen this on cable.
Where thousands of people join in throwing tomatoes at each other.
And they just trucks and trucks and trucks full of tomatoes, right?
This is like on my bucket list. This is amazing. Like one day I'm gonna do it. So La Tomatina occurs in the town of Buñol, which is near Valencia. So participants join in and they basically just hit each other with tomatoes, and the whole street's just covered with smushed tomatoes and tomato juice, and people look so happy. All of their clothes are drenched red. It looks kind of bloody, but it's not. It's all tomato juice. It's so fascinating, and there's so many other festivals that are kind of like this, like, you know, kind of like a fight.
There's a big water fight one in Thailand.
There's Holi,
the Indian one with the cornstarch that's colored.
The color festival. And so when I first read about the tomato festival, I thought it was like, oh, it must be some sort of religious thing because Holi is. And the water fight one is too. Actually, Tomatina, not religious at all.
Oh, it isn't?
It isn't. There's no real good origin story that's confirmed of how it started. One theory is there was like just a parade in the street, and there was this one guy who fell off a float and got really angry. And there was a vegetable stand. So in his rage, he flipped over the stand and, you know, was...
I don't know.
I agree with Dana. My skepticism alert is up.
The other theory is even crazier. There was like another kind of town celebration where people are out in the square, out on the streets, and there are these vermins eating some food or whatever. And this one guy decided to throw a tomato to like shoo off the animal and accidentally hit a guy. And the guy was like, what? You threw a tomato at me? I'm going to throw a tomato back. And it became
That does sound equally.
I like that one better.
Yeah. They both sound really kind of weak explanations to me.
Or really, it's just an excuse for a couple of kids to throw tomatoes at each other.
Right.
Seems like that's kind of.
How long has it been going on?
It started around 1940s.
Okay. So it's not super old.
Not super. Okay. So it's not that traditional.
Okay. Okay.
And you might think it might be traditional. It's like, oh, related to the harvest or something.
That was always my assumption. Like it evolved out of some, you know, tribute to some saint or some harvest festival. And
Nope. So the next year, I mean, according to both theories, the next year, the same kids showed up and they started throwing, they brought their own tomatoes this time and threw tomatoes at each other, and just more people joined in. And at first, you know, for the first probably decade, the police had to break people up. It wasn't like, oh, this looks like a fun thing. It's like, no, you are posing threat and danger to people of this town. But people just kept showing up every year around this time and throwing tomatoes at each other, and just kind of grew and grew and grew. Finally, in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, the town was like, let's embrace this.
It took 30 years.
Yeah. For them to make it official.
That's a long time.
It's a long time for them to miss out on cashing in on tourism. And then
so the town hall decided like, okay, this is going to be a town sponsored event. We're going to organize it. This is how party day, tomato throwing day. This is the itinerary.
Oh, okay. All right.
I thought it was just a whole day of chucking tomatoes at each other. No, there's like a certain schedule.
It would get old, I would think.
Itinerary.
Uh-huh.
10 a.m. Festivities begin with the first event of Tomatina, which is called which is called the ham pull.
Sure.
The palo yambon, right? Ham.
Oh, the ham pull.
Ham.
Ham bone. Like,
yeah. Oh, okay. The pork product.
Got
ham.
It.
Uh-huh.
Got
it.
The ham pull, of course.
Sure.
It's a pole, like a flag pole, that's greased up, and there's a ham on the top of the pole. And the goal is for people to climb the grease pole to reach the ham and make the ham fall to the ground.
Okay, and that is sort of a common event at a lot of traditional festivals.
Flag or something.
Right.
You know, people are already drunk, they're dancing, they're singing, waiting for the ham to drop. The ball drop. The ham drops, and that's the beginning of the tomato throwing. That signifies
the
start.
The
when the ham hits the ground. It gets real. Yeah. There is like sometimes a gun or some sort of sound effect that'd be like, okay, Ham is, we have confirmed.
Ham is on the ground.
Ham is on the ground.
Repeat.
They have tomatoes in trucks mm-hmm. already, and you know, everybody's gearing up and they start throwing tomatoes for exactly 1 hour.
Okay.
1 hour, and exactly 1 hour later, they will signify that this is the time to stop, and everybody stops. So really, depending on how good the ham catcher is or whatever, the ham faller,
yeah, I don't know, the ham tipper.
You're probably done by noon.
That, you know, honestly, like an hour, a solid hour of like throwing tomatoes and being hit by tomatoes, I'd probably be done as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Then they have water hoses and stuff for everybody for the whole street to clean up.
Then it's a water party.
Right,
then it's a,
right. Just well, let's giant, play Splash. Giant yeah. bags of chips. And
Eat salsa off of each other.
Yeah, you scrape it off yourselves.
So, well, that's the thing. Actually, they're grown specifically. Specifically for
Tomatina.
For Tomatina. They're cheaper and they have a, you know, the taste is not as good as
right. These are throwing quality tomatoes. Yeah.
There are five main rules.
All right.
It's like Fight Club. First rule of tomato throwing club.
Uh-huh.
The tomatoes have to be squashed before you throw them.
Oh.
You cannot throw a fully whole tomato. You gotta.
Because that hurts.
Yep. You gotta soften it up.
Interesting.
That's better.
Not allowed to just hurt people. Makes sense.
It's also juicier when it hits them. It's better.
Because if it just bounces off of you, it doesn't
Good point.
The same. Number two. No other projectiles except tomatoes are allowed.
That's fair.
You know, they just like they had to. Some jerk is like sticking like coins and rocks in like the middle of his tomatoes. Like no, blades. Just tomatoes, buddy.
There's a similar festival that where you throw oranges in Italy, I believe. Yeah,
that
I don't know
hurt
if you have
more,
to. Yeah, squash think. Those, but like tomatoes are softer. Okay, number three, Tomato Fight Club. Participants have to give way to the trucks, and the trucks are huge. They carry like I think. The numbers are 150,000 tomatoes.
Okay.
Single tomatoes over 40 metric tons.
Seems fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stay out of the way of trucks.
Don't get in the traffic.
Okay. Number four makes sense. Festival doesn't allow ripping off t-shirts.
I can see that being a problem.
Yeah.
Like you get caught up in the mob
frenzy.
You grab
people. Yeah.
Now, does that also include like Hulk Hogan style? Like, can I rip off my own t-shirt?
That is probably what it was for. It's like, keep your shirt
Stop
on.
Stop flexing. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Last rule of Tomato Fight Club. After the second shot signifying the end, no tomatoes can be thrown.
Right.
Or you will get in trouble. So in just the last year, they actually had to limit the tomato festival because, you know, it's fun. It sounds super fun. Lots of tourists come and they had to finally limit the number of people. Mm-hmm. So 5,000 tickets are allotted to locals of the town.
Okay.
And then three times that, 15,000 tickets allotted to foreigners.
Wow.
So that just gives you a sense of how many tourists come to this small town in Spain.
Just to flood this one main street.
Just to hurl tomatoes at each other. And now they even have like a online kind of a buy your ticket online and stuff. And now it's like, you know, sponsored by this, brought to you by Coca-Cola, you know, whatever. But it seems
How
like
fun.
A fun party. I think it's going to be on my bucket list.
Nice.
One day. I'm going to do that. Right. If you have been to the Tomato Festival.
Yeah, let us know. Send us a photo.
Yes. Sounds super fun. Maybe that's our next meetup.
Ooh.
Is a tomato festival.
What? That would be crazy.
That'd be awesome.
You're listening to Good Job Brain. Smooth puzzles. Smart trivia. Good Job Brain.
And speaking of a good time and party, I have a little mini quiz about party inventions.
Okay.
Party inventions.
Yes.
Okay.
Inventions are things that you see at a party.
To facilitate party having.
If
All right.
you will.
I have one in particular I'm hoping that you'll talk about, but I'll wait. I'll see.
Okay.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right.
So here we go. It's all kind of scientific. That's where my mind is at. All right. What party-related item comes in various widths? And sometimes features a concertina-type hinge.
Item comes in various widths.
I was thinking disco ball, but I don't know the
concertina is a type of instrument.
Mm-hmm. The piano?
Different width.
Hinge.
Like the little noisemakers, party hat.
Different
widths is what's throwing me.
It is a drinking straw.
Oh, it's the little bendy straw.
What the industry calls an articulated straw, we call it a bendy straw. That type of hinge, the little accordion style. Concertina is an accordion.
Oh, accordion.
Right. Mm-hmm. Of course.
It's called a concertina type hinge, and it comes in various widths, and they have different numbers assigned to the widths of... usually they're describing millimeters.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so you have something standards is like 2.5 or 3 to like up to 15, which is kind of like a bigger than a boba straw.
Okay.
So many, many widths. All right. Next question. So the Pillsbury Company, famous for their crescent rolls and frozen cookie dough and other frozen or ready-made baked goods.
And Doughboys.
And Doughboy, yeah.
Yep. They have the Doughboy as the company mascot.
Uh-huh.
What is his name?
Oh,
isn't it Poppin' Fresh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I read this. I was like, he has a name? Pillsbury Doughboy. Poppin' Fresh. No G. Poppin' apostrophe. Yeah.
And they have like they use that in the commercials, right? Like Poppin' Fresh dough or Poppin' Fresh rolls or something.
I think they used it more in maybe the 80s or 90s. And
the sounds
States.
Very 90s.
Yeah.
Poppin' Fresh.
It wasn't like a hip hop thing. Oh, okay. It was like.
Put some little sunglasses on.
It wasn't like popping and locking in a fresh way. It was like.
Like the rolls are pop. They're popping up fresh.
Yeah.
Can you do the Doughboy impression? I thought it was woohoo.
I thought it was hee hee.
Oh. We're like freaking people.
All right. We'll stop making that noise
like
in there.
All the animals.
The cat's looking at us like, what are you guys doing?
All right. Next question. What decorative item is an example of demonstrating the fluid mechanics phenomenon called the RT instability? I have a hint.
Oh.
Okay.
The RT instability is an interface between two fluids of different densities that occur when the lighter fluid is pushing out the heavier fluid. Dana.
Lava lamp.
Yes. Yeah. The lava lamp. All right. Last question. Time Out London published a list of 100 ultimate party songs.
Okay.
The song in the number one spot features 19 uh-ohs and 14 consecutive all rights, and its titular holler 25 times. What song is this?
Okay, holler. It's a party song.
And it says all right and on.
So the title comes up 25 times.
Oh, is it Everybody Dance Now?
19 uh-ohs and 14 consecutive all rights.
Is it Crazy
all
in
rights.
Love? No.
All right. Number one party song. You hear it and you just want to dance.
It's got to be something that's just like, what is it?
Hey, ya.
Oh, right.
Hey, ya.
All right.
It goes into Outkast.
That's the number one party song?
Established by Time Out London.
Got it.
All right, there you go. That's my little mini party quiz.
Excellent.
Good quiz.
So we talked a few episodes ago, I think, about the nursery rhyme, sing a song of sixpence, you know, because Dana, like, you know, you were talking about specifically how there was a story that it was a pirate recruiting song.
Yes. Sing a song of sixpence.
A pocket full of rye.
4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie.
Yeah, it was like a pirate message.
That's what Snopes planted.
Yeah.
And like they had planted it like as a way to troll. People were stealing their information. Yeah. Aside from that, there are actually a number of theories about what exactly this children's rhyme means. You know, that, it's an allegory for political conflict, or it's connected with the Reformation, and that although the verses are full of meanings, I'm not going to talk about what we know it isn't. I want to talk about what we do know. And what we do know is that in the past, at fancy dinner parties, it was indeed a real thing to serve a pie with live birds inside.
Oh my God!
You know, just for fun. And you'd cut it open and birds fly out.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, having the sexy girl in the birthday cake and they pop out. Like, oh, that's so weird.
It is kind of like that. You're right.
Releasing doves.
But it's grosser. You didn't bake the cake with the girl in it.
Yeah, how does that work? Are they baking the pie with the live birds in it, like slightly? Or are they bruleeing the top?
I will tell you exactly how they would pull off this feat.
All right.
So there's one particularly famous example that's cited.
Is this from a cookbook?
Well, Well, so yes, this is from a cookbook. This is from an Italian cookbook in the mid-1500s.
Oh, my God.
It was translated into English in 1598 and offers quite detailed instructions on how to pull off this prank pie. Essentially, what the prank would be is prank. What the serving is yeah. You bake a tiny, real little pie, smaller than a normal pie, and you get that along with some real birds inside of a larger shell. So you cut it open, the birds fly out, but then there still is at least something in the middle for you to eat.
Wait, if people covered eat with that? Bird poop.
I know. I don't want to eat a pie that like weird
birds
random
have been
birds.
Standing on. Yeah. Birds in distress have been marching over.
Stressing out.
What could be more sanitary? I mean, so here are some selections from the recipe. Quote, to make pies that the birds may be alive in them and fly out when it is cut up. And I'll summarize the intro to the recipe. Basically, what you start with a larger than normal pie shell, which they call a coffin.
Okay.
You start
pre-baked.
With the recipe I'm quoting here. Then having a pie of the bigness of the hole in the bottom aforesaid, you shall put into it, round about the aforesaid pie, as many small live birds as the empty coffin will hold, besides the pie aforesaid, which he's referring to the small real pie that you would
have made. Stuff as many birds in there as possible and fit the small pie.
Okay.
Yes. And this is to be done at such time as you send the pie to the table. So right before you serve it.
Got
you
it.
Know, you know, they're not hanging. Minimize the time in there. And set before the guests, where uncovering or cutting up the lid of the great pie, all the birds will fly out, which is to delight and pleasure show to the company.
The birds like attack.
You shall cut open the small pie, and in this sort, you may make many others and serve as you would a tort. So it's like, sorry, I scared you with the birds. Here's the real pie inside. All right.
Sure.
Why the hell are people baking birds into pies? Like, why is this even a thing? Why are you going to the efforts of pranking your guests like this? And I did a little bit of research into this, and like I admit the whole thing still sounds rather absurd, and it is, but it makes a little more sense in a larger context.
Okay.
All right. So if you were attending like a fancy dinner party in Europe, you know, like nobility or royals or just well-to-do people in the medieval era, you know, up even into the early Renaissance, you would frequently have many courses.
Uh-huh.
And between the courses, they would often have what are called entremets, which is from an old French term meaning between servings, between courses, entremets. And the idea of the entremets was entertainment food.
Okay.
Entertainment food.
What else?
So these are things, you know, to amuse you, to give a little bit of snack of some kind. And, you know, they think originally it probably just started as like really colorful or fanciful looking things, you know, like maybe a little dessert or something brightly colored to kind of just grab your attention, cleanse the palate. But it got a little bit more elaborate and a little bit more elaborate and more spectacle. So, Karen, you asked like what were some of the examples?
Yeah.
So a very common example was disguised foods.
Oh.
Okay. So a lot of the entremets were really focused on foods made to look like one thing but taste like another.
Meatloaf cake.
Tofurkey.
Yeah. Like the meatloaf cake. Like, so you might have some sweet, something really dessert-like or bready made to look up like a savory or a roast chicken or something.
That's awesome.
You might serve the meat of one animal stuffed into the skin of another animal.
So turducken.
Yep. Yeah. They would do elaborate things with birds like swans or peacocks even, where you would cook it, dress it, get all the meat prepared, and then refit it with the original plumage. So it's wheeled out to you, sort of looking lifelike with the plumage, but it's cooked. There would be a lot of little scenes created, you know, like that had particular meaning to the host or maybe the guest of honor. You know, it might be a recreation of a castle or a recreation of a little battle scene, you know, all made out of food.
Like
a diorama that you could eat. Some of the most intriguing examples to me, like, they sound like something out of a Mad Magazine version of Game of Thrones. Like, they're just silly. So my personal favorite is a scene that's brought out. It's a roasted chicken suited up to look like a medieval knight. So, little roasted chicken complete with little paper helmet. Little paper lance riding a roasted piglet like a horse. Riding into battle. Like anything else involving nobility and people with money showing off and trying to one-up each other, it just escalated to extreme heights. Like, it really was about the entertainment value. And a very common recurring thing that would be done would baking things into pies.
Did they put other animals in the pies?
Oh, yeah. Like yeah. cats? It could be as big as you wanted to make the pie. It was reported that at a reception in the 17th century, the Duke of Buckingham had prepared for his guests a fake pie concealing Geoffrey Hudson, who was a famous little person at the time among the courts of Europe and was friends with the guests that the Duke was celebrating.
This is where the sexy girl from the birthday cake comes
from. Yeah, you know what? I think that's probably the closest thing to the sexy lady popping out of the cake is Geoffrey Hudson popping out of a pie at a celebration by the Duke of Buckingham. Yes. Wow. So I think in that larger context, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. I'm like, yeah, you know what?
NBD.
I believe it. I believe NBD. It. Yeah.
They didn't even bake them in there.
Yeah. They were just not baked in. That's right. Which explains how they could still be alive and fly out. Yeah.
Wow. That's weird.
Yeah. Cool. So keep that in mind next time you hear that nursery rhyme.
A lot of time in their hands. Yeah. And speaking of a lot of time on their hands, I had a lot of time in my hands because in our final party quiz, I brought back Shakespeare Goes to a House Party.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The premise of this quiz is I picked famous big party song hits. Like when you go to a house party, they might be playing the song. Mm-hmm. And what I did is I wrote them into, all except one, into Shakespearean Elizabethan English couplets.
Okay.
And I have a William Shakespeare fake reading them, backed with some fresh beats.
Yay.
And you guys will listen to what I wrote and try to name the line of the lyric. You can name the song or the artist you want, but specifically it is alluding to a famous line of a famous party song.
Awesome.
Okay.
And see if you can identify them. Here we go. Let's start with the non-rhyming, probably the easiest one, so everybody gets a flavor of it. Mm-hmm. Here you go, and buzz in with your answer.
Tis mine banquet, and ball with sorrow mine eyes shall.
Oh.
Dana.
It's my party.
And I'll cry if I want to.
Yes. Yeah.
Who sang that? Was that?
Leslie Gore.
Oh.
Tis mine banquet, and ball with sorrow mine eyes shall. It's my party, and I cry if I want to. Next one.
You there, good lad, not any reason for lament. I say, good lad, kneel up from that pavement.
Oh,
you guys are quick.
Yeah, it's YMCA,
yeah.
Yes.
Young man, there's no need to feel down.
I said, young man.
Pick yourself off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. You there, good lad, not any reason for lament. I say, good lad, kneel up from that pavement.
Nice.
Okay, this next one was a weird line of lyric. We'll see if everybody gets it. All right, here we go.
A jug of whiskey on my fangs. It will clean and burn. For when 'tis time to part this evening, I shan't return.
Okay. Dana.
Is this Kesha?
Yes!
Yeah. Oh!
The line is, brush my teeth with a bottle of Jack.
Right, right.
Because when I leave for the night, I ain't coming back.
Whiskey on my fangs.
Yeah, I was like, well, bottle of Jack, I guess that's a jug of whiskey.
Yeah, they
didn't really have.
I like its fangs, though.
Yeah, because I didn't want to say teeth, right? So that's the thing. When I write these, I'm not doing one to one. Like, I'm never going to repeat the words.
You got to make us work for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, next one.
I beckon thee, let sweetness cascade down mine skin. 'Tis your affection I desire within.
Is it, is it? Is this a Def Leppard? Pour some sugar on me.
Yes. Pour some sugar on me.
Nice.
All right, and last one, probably my favorite one. Here we go.
Mm-hmm. The air hath ripened, feverish in these parlors. I say, disrobe thine ensemble of coats and collars.
Dana. As Nelly, hot in her.
Hot in her.
So take off all your clothes.
I try to make these all rhyme.
That's good. So. Yeah, that was good. The rhyme into rhyme. Yeah, it pays off.
Feverish and lament in pavement. That was good.
Thank you. All right. Well, you guys did very well. It's Shakespeare Goes to a House Party, thanks to William Fakespeare. And that is our show. We'll be back next week with Chris in hand. In hand? No. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening to our show. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.